If you will consent to burden your soul with a vow that you should never make and a knowledge you should never dream about, I will promise you in return...
You will promise me in return...
I will promise you a very entertaining evening.
Your offer is far too idiotic to be declined. Permit me here and now to promise as a good comrade and a fellow artist that I will not report any of this, whatever it is, to the police.
So yeah, I just amassed a huge collection of like terrible sounding MP3s from that, you know.
And viruses.
Yes, definitely, yeah. Just, you know, like...
Game trolling!
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at your favorite albums from yesterday, from today, and from tomorrow. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and joining me, as always, is the man who owns the house, who is the master of disaster, Mr. Jeff Calhoun.
It's a lot of disaster this week.
Good evening. Since we're all strangers to each other, let's get acquainted with a drink, shall we?
On this episode, Keith and Jeff welcome singer-songwriter Mo Troper into Thunderlove Studio to chat about power pop, his career, and the legacy of Chris Bell's I Am the Cosmos.
Every night I tell myself I am the cosmos. I am the wind. Back on YouTube, back up again. Just when I was starting to feel okay, you're
as our friend of the pod, S.W. Loudon, likes to say, power pop is having a moment.
It seems to be. I'm in a moment where I wonder if I've just liked the correct people and feeds on Instagram to be receiving this moment, or if it really is like a cultural, like a musical thing that's happening. It seems like a recurring theme in my life.
Yes, same here. So we have Mo Troper on this week, who's going to talk to us about Chris Bell's I Am the Cosmos, which is one of those legendary songs.
You and I, Keith, have talked about Big Star, and I think both of us fall into that camp of I can listen to it and enjoy it and appreciate it, but I don't seek it out. You know, if I want power pop, I tend to lean maybe a little more modern. You know, I'll reach for the Cars before I'll reach for Big Star. I don't want to take anything away from Big Star. Wonderful band, beautiful music.
For sure.
Honestly, I'd take Mo Troper's music over Big Star, I think. And there are a lot of people that would probably slap me for that. But
yeah, Mo might even be one of them. Who knows?
Mo might take issue. Let's not tell him.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But I will say, in preparation for this interview, I did listen to I Am the Cosmos a number of times. And the more I listened to it, the more it hit me.
I actually went and watched the Big Star documentary, which 10 out of 10 would recommend. It was an excellent documentary. Certainly made me more interested in them. That Big Star documentary paints a very compelling picture of the members of the band. But it does not paint a comprehensive picture of what Chris Bell experienced. There seems to be a backstory to all of this that I hope we can unravel a bit. I'd like to talk to Mo about his music as well and explore some of that, because I think there's a journey there.
I had not been familiar with his catalog, and I was quite taken aback by how extensive it is.
Right? He's been pretty prolific since he started publishing albums. A lot of great content in there, and a diversity. For my palate, I like his earlier work. He's getting more and more experimental. It's kind of why I say I like Motroper better than I like Big Star. So
without any further ado, here's our conversation with Motroper.
It is a lot. Chris Bell, Big Star specific, zoom out, power pop, zoom back in, Motroper specific, zoom back out, zoom back in, out, in, out, in. Did I mention I'm sober right now?
Mo, thank you very much for joining us. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of things tonight, but where I want to start is the article you wrote for the Power Pop Journal, the inaugural Power Pop Journal, Remember the Lightning, a Guitar Pop Journal.
Yes, Steve's.
Now, the title of your article is Riding in Cars with Boys, the Eternal Heartache of Chris Bell's I Am the Cosmos. In the article, you focus on Chris Bell and Big Star. I got hipped to Big Star through The Replacements and the song Alex Chilton. And the thing that's always escaped me is I've never quite understood what makes Big Star so significant and so impactful. Can you help us understand?
Well, it's interesting. I've talked to a couple people about this recently because I'm like 31 now, but I still try and keep tabs on like what's going on with younger musicians in Portland and like teach lessons. That's like part of what I do is my day job. So I teach like younger students who also make music around town. And there are like, I've had this conversation with people my age generally, and then people like maybe 10 years younger than me, 5 to 10 years younger than me about Big Star. And I think my people who are my age, I think got hip to Big Star via Elliott Smith and the cover of 13 that's on New Moon. I think that was kind of like, our version of Alex Chilton, you know, like the millennial version of Alex Chilton. I think like, so there's kind of this, it seems like there's this sentiment among like really, you know, pretty hip music kids who are like really into Elliott Smith, who listen to Big Star and they're like, this just sounds like 38 Special, or like, you know, they might not have that vocabulary for it, but they're like, this just sounds like a classic rock band. And don't really see, like, can't really make the connection between like Elliott Smith and Big Star. Like they're like one of these things. It's just a, pardon me. Yeah, like one of these things is.
And for the listening audience, I know that sounds like a bong rip. I assure you it was not.
Just some rice. And then, yeah. Excuse me. Well, I do this. That's not really an answer to your question. That's an argument for why Big Star might not be as special as some people think they are. But I guess I just think it's like inexplicable, sort of. I think that like, there are a lot of ways in which Big Star does just kind of seem like a classic rock band. And then there are, I think if you spend a lot of time with that music, it starts to feel really special. Worlds better than something like 38 Special. Like it just feels really meaningful. And I think that there is also a link to Elliott Smith and like more indie like that, especially with the acoustic stuff.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just like, the way that I feel about it is that it's, and I feel like this is kind of a common take, is if you love the Beatles, then you listen to Number One Record, and it sort of makes that, it's like, I never really thought I could make music that sounded like the Beatles. And then I heard Number One Record and I was like, oh, this is actually like kind of, and it like these, this band makes that feel attainable, or like they're able to sort of like do it in a way that like a human being can understand or like wrap their head around, sort of. And I think that for me was really powerful. And I think that's why they're regarded as like the quintessential power pop band, you know, because it's like, it just feels like, oh, I can do this, you know, or I can try and do this, as opposed to like, you know, Strawberry Fields Forever or something, where it's like, or even like an early Beatles song, you know, like Any Time at All, where I'm just like, how can a 21-year-old come up with those chord changes, you know?
Right.
I don't know. Yeah, there's just something about it that feels more attainable. And I think that that's what makes it feel more human and makes it feel really special. You know, it's like sort of these kids who are writing like just beyond their abilities. Like they were just, it was just, you know, like really just super precocious.
I will take that for sure.
In the article, you seem to lean in a little bit to the role Chris Bell played in that group. I mean, Alex Chilton obviously is, you know, the face and the voice, but you seem to take a particular interest in Chris's role. Was there a genesis behind that?
Yeah, I think just hearing I Am the Cosmos and like it sort of immediately rising to the top of my, I mean, you know, there are days where I think that that's like the greatest song ever written. And I think that like, I love all the Alex Chilton stuff too. But I think that hearing that, for me, I mean, that is not something that feels attainable to me. It feels like very transcendent. I think in that article, I compare it to Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it feels really different from something like, you know, like She's a Mover or something, where it's like, oh, this is a really talented person fucking around. You know, I think that like there's something about the Chris Bell stuff that is like deeply earnest and deeply serious. And I think that I feel like Alex Chilton and Chris Bell worked together when they kind of like, before their sensibilities really diverged, you know. And I think it would have been cool to see like a big star with one songwriter who was like really vulnerable and one songwriter who was just like a shithead, you know, like just a total ironist. And I love Alex Chilton for that. But it makes it hard for me to, I never know if he's being serious. Like even with like I'm in Love with a Girl or September Girls, it's like, are you being serious? And then there's like those moments on Radio City that we now know Chris Bell had some involvement in. And I think that those are the moments where it's like, oh my God, like this is so devastating, you know, or like it's just so painful.
We're recording this right in the middle of May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month. And in the Big Star documentary, Nothing Can Hurt Me, the story sort of dances around Chris Bell's mental health. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
Well, I know that he was committed, or maybe voluntarily admitted himself. I don't know the details. I've read a little bit of the book. There's like a Chris Bell biography. And I know that he did struggle with it and was like, I think he had like major depressive disorder. Like he was diagnosed as a depressive person. But I don't know much beyond that. Like, obviously there was like a very different culture around that's especially, I mean, I imagine, especially in the South, you know, from what else I know about him and his life, it just seems like there's just so much shit going on that probably compounded whatever he was predisposed to.
In the article, you do make, you briefly touch on, I forget your line exactly, but it's something to the effect of, I don't want to go into a mental health and creativity discussion.
Yeah, I think that there's his mental health. And then there's also his sexuality, which is sort of the elephant in the room. I have heard, basically heard on good authority that like there was a lot of content on that was cut from the Big Star documentary. I don't think that anybody at, you know, any of Chris Bell's like surviving family members want that discussed at all. And it just seems like it's such a footnote in like the story of Big Star and the story of the band. And there is some stuff like, I've also heard on good authority that there's like a lot of stuff between Chris Bell and Alex Chilton and John Fry, like a lot of really pretty juicy stuff. And I do think that it's like, you know, well, like this is all anyone talks about when they talk about rumors, but suddenly because it's like some gay stuff, like it's just like, no, it has nothing to do with the music. You know, it's like, give me a break. Like, it's all there in the music, you know. And it's the, you know, I mean, if that stuff, you know, if that rumor is true that Chris Bell was just like hopelessly in love with Alex Chilton, I mean, to me, that context makes that music so much more devastating. This person's like poor mental health, like this the tortured genius myth or whatever. At the same time, it's like, well, there's a lot to suggest that he was tortured and he also was a genius. It's like sometimes that is not a myth. Sometimes that's real, you know? And it's like, I don't know. I've heard a lot of people sort of in recent years talk about that stuff like it's a myth. And it's like, well, let's not overcorrect. Like, you know, sometimes it is, and sometimes it leads to like further stigmatization of mental illness. At other times, it sort of like deprives this story of something that is like really interesting and important, you know.
For sure.
Just because it doesn't fit some surviving family member's narrative of what they want to be the truth doesn't distance it from being the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
To be clear, if you're listening and you don't know the Big Star story, I mean, Memphis, Tennessee is not a hotbed of progressive ideas.
The first time I ever read about that stuff with Chris Bell was in a John Jeremiah Sullivan essay. But way before, I think, well, no, I don't know if it was way before, but it must have been before the Big Star documentary came out. And it's not even really, it's sort of about that. It's like, you know, what was the climate like sort of in Memphis in the early 70s? Like, could this have even existed? And the first time I read some of that, the first time I heard some of that stuff, like Chris Bell was probably gay, like maybe was in love with Alex Chilton. And I think that John Jeremiah Sullivan is like really careful. I think anybody who talks about it ever, even the people who suspect it's probably true, are careful not to just be like, have you heard, you know, like, cause it's like that does feel kind of fucked. It's just really delicate. And at the same time, it feels really important, I think. And I think that was another thing I mentioned in the essay was like, I'm not the person to write this. I'm not the person. I sort of had the realization, like going through that whole process of being like, this is really interesting. This is something that somebody who makes a documentary needs to tackle, or like some journalist needs to do like a proper piece on.
And tell us about bringing that into your world. I mean, you say that you hear that song and it makes you wonder if you can deliver that kind of Beatles quality. You know, what was it like for you to bring that into the studio and take a stab at putting, you know, the Mo Troper spin on, or if there is a spin? It seems like a fairly faithful cover.
Yeah, I don't. So the goal there was my friend Evan was teaching me how to use a 24-inch tape machine, like a 24-inch, a 24-track 24-inch tape, 24-track 2-inch tape machine, Otari, that he had at his studio. I was basically just messing around with it, and I just was like burning to, you know, I had nothing of mine that I wanted to record. And I was like, I'll just record the Sign of the Cosmos cover. Like, that's a great song, and see if I can get close to those tones. Cause it's such a crazy recording too. It wasn't any kind of spin. I mean, I think of that stuff as like, it's not like clinical or like, I feel very sort of like, emotionally involved in like a cover when I'm recording a cover, but it is kind of like practice where I'm like, I want to sort of like really try and deconstruct this or reconstruct this, or like, you know, I really want to sort of like live in it or like really try and nail everything as hard as I can. To me, that's like very fun. You know, it's not, I don't think that like, I don't think that that's a song you need to like take any artistic liberties with, you know? I just wanted to do it as faithfully as possible.
I often get asked by some people I know, like, what is power pop? And you gave perhaps one of the most succinct, brilliant definitions of it. And I'll read it off to you. Power pop is a slightly pathetic and vulnerable admission dressed up in razor sharp, jangling guitars and chest beating bluster. Brilliant.
Thanks.
You define I Am the Cosmos as the quintessential power pop saying, power pop song.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can accurately call it other than power pop. Yet it's one of the few power pop classics that manages to bust through stuffy genre prescriptions. Okay, that's pretty well said. What are some of the stuffy genre prescriptions?
Well, yeah, so I guess the other thing about this song, I'll start by just saying that the other thing about this song that was really powerful to me when I first heard it was just how enthrall to the Beatles it is. I mean, it interpolates the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs from She Loves You, which is something I didn't know until, I didn't make that connection until recently, which is just like mind bending to me. But at the same time, it is really just like so emotional. And I think that was kind of always what I was looking for as a teenager, you know, and still it's what I'm looking for. But I think like, you know, I was like, oh, people say that Weezer's power pop, but sometimes it's like kind of suffocating. Like it's like too emotional kind of, you know? And then I think if you go like really, you can go really far in the other direction where it's just like straight up Beatles cosplay. It feels like completely deracinated from, like, it's like AI music essentially, you know? And I think that like I Am the Cosmos, I was like, oh my God, this is like such a, it's like kind of structurally similar to something that would be a hit in the 60s. And yet it is like, the lyrics are so fucked up that it never would have stood a chance commercially, you know? And I think that that's also sort of the Brian Wilson connections, like, you know, somebody who really wore their heart on their sleeve and paid the price. You know, sometimes I think that people who make power pop feel freer to do that kind of thing because they just know it's not really a commercially viable form of music, maybe. I guess to answer your question about genre prescriptions, I mean, I think that, I don't know, I feel like pathos, or like, you know, really like a song that is very clearly about a real human emotion is not really valued in like the power pop world. And so I don't think it's like, I don't think that people are like against it necessarily. I think it's just like not, and I'm making generalizations too, but I think that it's just not like, it seems like sort of like when I read some of those power pop blogs or whatever, it's like, the canon is always sort of like, it's like how close to the Beatles can they get musically, or like the Raspberries or Badfinger or whatever. And it's like, I don't really see a lot of attention paid to like lyrics, emotional content. And I think that to me is like, it makes this kind of music that should be very visceral. It turns it into something very cerebral. And like that, I think is whack. And I don't like that kind of power pop, you know? I mean, I think that one thing that I've one complaint with the song that I've heard some people that I know some people have is like that it's too slow. And I think that, yeah, people like associate people. I think that generally power pop is like pretty fast, like mid tempo, to brisk, moderato to, but you know, it's like, and the Cosmos is really fucking slow. And the pre-Varisbed version is even slower. Yeah. It's just like that. That's one way in which I think it's like, doesn't have a lot in common with like, you know, some of the other canonized power pop songs. And I think it just sounds really, it's like so tuneful and so layered, but it doesn't really like sound like a record by like the Raspberries or like Emmett Rhodes. There's something very like cavernous about it and like washy, and like the way at the end where like there's like a clipping and like one of the, you can hear like one of the channels go out for a sec. Like it just is like a crazy recording that gives it that. I mean, I can't even imagine what that song would sound like if it was recorded like a 2020 record or something. Like it just would, it almost is like, it's just like everything is like perfectly reflects like every other aspect of the song. You know, everything is just like in total lockstep. Sorry, I'm just like gushing about the song as opposed to answering your question.
That's quite all right.
Cool. So I guess those are the ways in which I feel like it's really distinct. I think it's very emotionally resonant, and it sounds crazy, and it's slow. It's like a dirge.
A
power pop dirge. It's like a nightmare kind of. Of a song. It's like a nightmare version of a Beatles song, you know.
I think the misconception about power pop, to your point, is that it's really mid-tempo, fast tempo, happy, happy, happy stuff. Given what we're just talking about, would it be out of line to say a song like Here Comes a Regular by The Replacements could certainly fall under the power pop umbrella, as we've just discussed, like I Am the Cosmos, right?
Yeah. I mean, The Replacements are, again, a great example. And a great example of a band that there are some replacement songs, like especially some of the stuff on Tim, where it's like, what can you call this other than power pop? At the same time, it obviously transcends the genre. Like nobody really thinks about The Replacements as a power pop band. And it's like, why is that? Because they fucking mean it, you know? It's not just like this kind of like dorky, like whatever, you know, it's like very, and sometimes it is dorky, but in a way that like feels very real to me, I guess, you know?
Yeah, very much so.
It's an interesting conversation because when I think of the genre, I typically think of style over substance. There's certain instrumentation that lends itself to, you know, if I hear a tambourine in a song, the chances of me labeling it as power pop go up 300%, you know? Like it's just so it's interesting to pull it apart and say, you know, it's Keith Higgins. It's not academic, but there's an intelligence to the lyric that, you know, it doesn't all have to be. I'll cite a premium example of this is, I think Sloan is a band that really is successful delivering really smart lyrics and substantive lyrics. And sure, there might be a tambourine in there and it might be a certain beats per minute, but it's, you know, it's also smart music, which is why I think that's a band that's been so successful over many albums delivering in that format.
Totally. Yeah. I think that the bands that, including Sloan, the bands that the sort of like 90s wave of power pop bands really got that. And I think to me, like the stuff like 2020 or Shoes or whatever, it's like that. I think that stuff is cool as like a historical document kind of. I don't really like, there aren't any Badfinger records I go back and listen to. I love the singles. But I think that some of it does feel very dumb to me. And I think that like, I do really identify, I guess, with it. Just feels like a lot of those 90s power pop bands, like, you know, Teenage Fan Club, Matthew Sweet, Sloan, like really clocked that. Like they were really like, oh, there's something subversive about like taking Beatle music and sort of making it really smart. Like that is kind of a weird, cool thing to do. And I think that like, yeah, it's just like a very fruitful sandbox kind of, you know, and I think that I guess what pains me, I guess, is just like the fact that that still isn't, that it's still kind of like, does this band sort of like hit all the marks kind of like aesthetically or whatever, like do they you know, how do, does it, you know, do they wear Chelsea boots, do they have Rickenbackers? Like it's kind of like very, it is very style over substance. And it's like, even when there's even a band like Sloan, when I see that band being discussed in power pop circles, it's like, you know, like it feels very much sort of like rooted in that type of like surface level discussion, and not really like, okay, but talk about like the song, you know, like this is art we're talking about here, not like a fucking ad, you know? And so I guess that to me is why I'm the Cosmos, I guess, feels really special. It feels like ground zero for that kind of like idea of power pop, where it's like, sure, no, you can do this and you can really mean it. And you can really like, and those two things are, it's not a commercial like recipe for success, but it's like a really cool artistic thing that they're like, you know, some freaks out there will like really vibe with and love, you know.
That's, and that, I got to be honest with you, that's why I love your definition of power pop so much, because it is, yeah, vulnerability, you know, dressed up. And I think to what we're just talking about, style over substance, people miss the substance. They talk about what they're looking like, but that's that vulnerability. That's what drew me into the Replacements. And upon, yeah, repeated listening of I Am the Cosmos, that's eventually what drew me in. It, yeah, was tough to get through. It took me a number of listens. Yeah. It took me a number of listens before it really drew me in, and it really did impact me, you, yeah, know, and it's, sure, it's the crown jewel of sad bastard music.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Big time.
Nobody worries about kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Let's jump the tracks a little bit and get away from I Am the Cosmos. And I want to start with your early recordings, Beloved, Gold, and even into Exposure and Response. From what I can see, that was 2016, 2017, 2017. Like those are three records in pretty rapid succession. I do hear a lot of those bands that we mentioned. I hear Teenage Fan Club and Sloan in some of your early recordings. I want to say, I think a part of it is just that you have an ear for a good hook. I think you understand what, you know, connectivity in music means and how to turn a phrase, especially how to turn a phrase.
Nice.
There's a consistency to those three records that I wonder if there was something in your head that was informing your music. You know, where were you drawing inspiration from as you were getting started with those first three records?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I guess first, just to clarify, Gold is like a collection of songs that I did with bands before I put out Beloved, like high school bands, kind of, like high school, early 20s bands. I think a lot of that stuff was informed by, I mean, it's definitely like rougher. I think that there was a really pretty vibrant like emo and pop punk scene in Portland at the time. And I think like, you know, like the closest, like pretty much all of my bandmates, like I couldn't really at the time, you know, I didn't know anybody else who was like, yeah, I love Spilt Milk by Jellyfish or whatever. You know, I think that now that I'm older, I find that a lot more, because I think that those, as time goes on, like those people start to just like circle the drain they all meet. But at the time it was like, you know, I couldn't find anybody to play music with who really liked the kind of music I wanted to make. And it was like, it was kind of just like, well, you know, Weezer, and be like, oh yeah. It's like, all right, let's do Weezer, kind of. And so I think that that's the common thread. You know, it's just like having a band of people who don't really know what it is I'm going for. And I think that that can sometimes be cool, but I listen to those recordings now and I'm like, it was just kind of confused.
You call me over, wounded critter. I can't move any faster. If I could, I'd be a
do you feel like you found some of that with Natural Beauty? Because to me, those first three records, you can kind of cluster together and say that's early Mo. And then Natural Beauty seems like an album where you really found a lot of maturity, both as a songwriter and as a producer. Like the quality of the recordings went up.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I do think that it was healthy for me to do. I mean, I went really far in the opposite direction where I was like, this is the kind of the version of the thing I was doing if it was just all me. And I listened to that record. You know, I have my own issues with that recording. It does feel a little stiff to me. But I think it was like a really good learning experience and really liberating in the sense that I was able to like get away from the things that I didn't like. Like it was just kind of like, yeah, me embracing sort of like the kind of pop music I really liked, you know, like, no, I want this to sound like the Left Bank. Like, I don't want there to be any loud guitars at all. You know, like, I just want it to be like total, like dorky 60s music. And I do think that that was like really, really good for me.
Any 60s bands in particular that you would cite as inspiration?
The big ones, Beatles and the Beach Boys, love the Kinks, love the Move. And Roy Wood, love Left Bank, not as consistent as any of those bands. Same with the Hollies. I really like some of that, like late, like right before Graham Nash leaves, or like Evolution and Butterfly. I think that stuff was like huge for me. Yeah, some of that like proto prog stuff, I think is really cool.
Yeah,
and like I, you know, like the poppier. I guess this is sort of getting into the early 70s now, but like the poppier Peter Gabriel era Genesis stuff. And there was a lot of like just music like that that I was like drawing from, like maybe even plagiarizing with Natural Beauty. Like just, I was just like, I'm just going to like go, like this is like music I'm like afraid to listen to in the car unless the windows are like rolled all the way up, kind of pop music, you know. And I was just like, I'm just gonna go for it and sort of do my best version of that kind of thing.
And I love to ask about specific tunes, and I know that this is many years ago, so if you don't remember, no big deal.
Sure.
Almost Full Control.
That's an interesting one because it's a co-write. It's the one co-write on the record. And I wrote with my friend Nick, who I was in a band with called Teen Spot many years ago. And we basically wrote a bunch of songs for a Teen Spot record that was never made. And it's like, I think pretty much done now, but we were still kind of like mining that, that material. The song itself is like about a deteriorating relationship. And there was somebody, I mean, this is kind of like a common theme, I guess, in my life and also in my songs, I think, is this like self-consciousness about wanting control, like self-consciousness around being a control freak. And so there was somebody who basically wrote a song that wasn't about me. They wrote a song about me called Full Control. And so I just was like, that's where the title comes from. Kind of disconnected from the actual like content, like lyrical contents. It's got a part in it that sounds a lot like The Birds. Speaking of plagiarism, it's got the, I'll feel a whole lot. I mean, that's another band I love. Of course. Yeah. Sorry. That's like, maybe that's a shitty answer.
Why does she wait when he's turning her away? She thought she was out of the woods, but he led her heart astray. It's a cancer, she said, and it's killing both of us. All these tears just turned those gears to rest. He can hardly bear the thought of her elsewhere. Passion overfed is a monster pulling at its hair. I can't believe I spent my youth like this, she thought. Weary from the war, she wished she'd never fought. Bleary-eyed and distraught.
These bands that you're referencing that you enjoyed, how did you get exposure to them? Is Elliott Smith ground zero and then you just sort of went out from there, or?
Yeah, a lot of it is my mom, who's like actually a huge Replacements and Kinks fan. So those found out about, and it was really special. Like my mom doesn't really do a whole lot anymore, but I like saw the Replacements with her when they reunited the first time and came to Portland. That was very special. So she was very much like a cool, like, you know, my mom had me when she was like 20. So she's like a cool Gen X mom, you know? So that was really cool. And you know, like, my dad, I have a weird relationship with him, but he, was like a huge record guy and like super, a huge head, like super into the Beatles, like obsessive interest in the Beatles that I was just around a lot for like my early childhood. And then a lot of it was like the internet. I mean, I think I started to circle the drain, like really early. I mean, I just was like, you know, heard. So one thing is like, I don't know if you remember, iTunes had like that sidebar that was like a recommended, it was like related artist sidebar. And that was how I found a lot of stuff. It would start with a band like Weezer maybe. And then it would be like related artist Red Cross, related artists Jellyfish, related artists Owsley. Like I would just go deeper and deeper. And there were like sort of multiple branches, because then there's also like an influence. There was like an influenced by, and it'd be like The Move or something. And then I'd be like, what's this band that really influenced Jellyfish? Like, that's weird. So that was how I found out about a lot of stuff. Forums as a kid, how I found out about a lot of stuff.
So just an insatiable hunger for more.
yeah, totally. Yeah. And definitely, you know, definitely it was, I feel like downloading music illegally was really easy still. Like the Mediafire era is sort of when I came of age, where I could just type like literally like, oh, I heard about this Red Cross album called like Phase Shifter. And I would just like type in the title of the record, Red Cross download, into Google. And the first hit's like, you know, album download blank at Mediafire. And so, yeah, I just amassed a huge collection of like terrible sounding MP3s from that, you know.
And viruses.
Yes, definitely, yeah. A lot of those albums are really out of sequence. And so, like, there are some albums that I, when I finally heard like the real versions, I was like, this is fucked up. Like, there's no way Either Or actually by Elliott Smith is one of those where there's like no, there was no like sequence that came with the download. So it just like whatever I loaded it into iTunes that first time, that was just what it was to me. And like still, like to this day, I cannot listen to the, like Say Yes is the last song on that record. I'm like, that is fucked up. that is perverse. I cannot do that. That's, I would say those are like the main ways I found out about a lot of stuff.
Very cool. Moving ahead in your career to the album MTV, I'm going to ask the obvious question. Did you have any copyright issues or trademark issues with calling it that?
No. And I've heard that with titles, you can kind of call it whatever you want. But they did pass on a write-up. I had like a publicist try and pitch the record to MTV. And we were kind of like, wouldn't this be funny? And they were like, absolutely not.
you mean a corporate juggernaut doesn't have a huge sense of humor? I'm shocked.
Yeah, I think MTV News just went under, which is really pretty tragic for all the freelancers who work there, but less tragic for the company, which has always sucked. So I guess that's the way it goes.
Well, let's talk about that record. You were kind of chugging along with, and you know, we talk about style over substance, but it's not just, I don't know if this element of pop music is more style or substance, but I think one of the things that we look for in pop music is familiarity and to some extent predictability. I think that you had a comfortable spot with that predictability in the music where you were kind of leaning into the what felt familiar.
Yeah.
MTV ain't that. I think if you were Sloan and Matthew Sweet before, now it's like, you remember the Ween record where they had the Scotchgard bong on the cover? Like that's where
cool. MTV that's awesome.
Goes to me is like, okay, Mo found the Scotchgard bong on this one.
Yeah, totally. What's weird is that I actually think it is the most personal record I've ever made, by a long shot. And I think that Dilettante, the record I did right before that, is more sort of the like, it is a lot of goofs and gags, and some of it is very personal, but it's all sort of like mixed in with stuff that is like, you know, like there's like an Elvis Costello pastiche called Wet T-Shirt Contest that I like wrote in the shower. So it's like, it's just like a sort of a motley collection of songs, but MTV is like pretty much, it's just really personal music that I think is, and it's not, it wasn't contrived, I think, in any way. It was like a friend of mine, Tony Molina, was like, you should record with tape. And I was like, cool. And got an 8-track. My friend happened to be selling 2 8-tracks and then bought one and was like, I'm going to make a record on tape. And then did it and then released it. Like, you know, it was like, finished it in April, I think, got it mastered in May, came out in September. It was like an insane turnaround.
And so you were limited to 8 tracks the whole time?
Not exactly, because you can do something called ping-ponging. And I was also sort of using the computer to bus. Are you familiar with ping-ponging? Okay, so this is the beauty of a 8-track, is that you can do this in stereo. Which is not something you can do on a 4-track. You can do it in mono. But just to use a 4-track as an example, you'll basically record 3 tracks on tracks 1 through 3 and then bounce tracks 1 through 3 onto a single mono track 4. And then now you basically, the idea is that you do the same thing with 1 and 2 and then bounce 4 and 1 and 2 to 3. So you basically will always have a certain amount of tracks open. You can go totally crazy with this, like just hog shit with 8 tracks. I just got to a point where I was like sending it, you know, I was doing a bunch of that, sending it to the computer, sending it back to the tape machine, speeding it up. Like I just got so in the tape zone. Like I was like, Tony Molina's right. This is crazy. and it really just changed the way, I mean, you know, it just, fundamentally changed the way I thought about recording and music, I think. And it changed the way I listened to records.
Yeah.
Especially records made in the 60s.
There's a lot of experimentation, I feel like, in this new record.
Yeah, I think so. But it's just insofar as it's me trying to figure out how to use a tape machine, I think, you know. But there was not any, like, I wasn't like, here's the, you know, like, here's the song that sounds like Django Reinhardt. You know, there wasn't like, there was no point in making that record where I was like, I'm gonna, here's the weird song. It was like, there are, like, I do sort of generally want to make records where there's a lot of, it covers a lot of ground stylistically. I mean, that is what I really like about Ween, is that it's like, you never know what you're going to get. And I think that I tried to do that, or I just tried to sort of like, I just felt totally sort of like open to all of that stuff. Like, I was like, oh, I have an idea for a song that sounds like this. Like, I'll do that. Like, it sounds like it needs harmonica. Like, should I actually do that? Harmonica is kind of like a dumb instrument. Like, sure, fuck it. You know, like, it was just like, it was in some ways, I think, the opposite of experimentation to me, because it just felt so organic. You know, and I was really like, I think that the fact that I was doing it on tape too, like cassette, I was like, it doesn't matter what I do. Like, it's, that's kind of like, I'm already sort of going into it knowing that it's going to sound like it was recorded to cassette, and that sort of like makes everything else feel okay. So, you know,
walk us through the motivation behind The Only Living Goy in New York.
Well, the other thing about some of the songs on this record is that they were very like, coming from a deeply subconscious place. So I don't really know. I can't like justify that. Also, I'm Jewish, so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense.
Oh, okay.
As a first person narrative, but it is like about, and it's about being in New York. It's just about being in New York at like a really weird time in my life, I think, and feeling really like just alien, I guess, like sort of just the experience of being like not Jewish enough for Jews in New York.
For what felt like a million miles to the liquor store. It was raining so hard that I fell out of style. The only living goy. Back at the crash spot, I indulged my habits, then fell asleep on the floor. I took my best shot, but I'm so out of practice, the only living goy in New York.
There being no Jewish cultural presence in Portland and feeling like always sort of the most Jewish person in Portland. So I think that that was something that I did consciously want to write a song about for a long time, but I wasn't really expecting it to like grab me in that way. And then I was like, oh, it sounds like Simon and Garfunkel. It could have this title. It would be funny to say this in a song. So yeah, that's one of my favorite songs on that record. And the line about the bagel, I went to get a bagel, and I think I asked for it toasted. And one of the people I was with was like, you don't do that here. Is that true? You don't ask for it toasted? Like that it's so, like at some places it's so good that it's like sort of asking for like a side of Heinz ketchup with a steak or something, I think was like sort of what they were getting at.
It was never a problem for me. I like my bagels toasted.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
No, it's funny you mentioned that the Simon and Garfunkel song. I think I saw the title and was immediately went across the pond to Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine's The Only Living Boy in New Cross.
Okay.
I was like expecting some, you know, techno beats.
Yeah.
Has there been, I'm always curious when you see a song off of a record that seems to catch some wind in its sails ahead of the rest of the record, you know, a single, if you will.
It's
increasingly irrelevant term, but I Fall Into Her Arms seems to be that song off this record.
Yeah.
Was that something that you were pushing, or is that something that the audience just latched on to?
Well, I mean, it was the song that accompanied the record announce, and that was like pretty, it wasn't something I was pushing, but it was pretty obvious, I think, like to me and the people at Lamo, like it was like, this should just be the first single. But no, it was not something that I was pushing really. I mean, I'm not happy about this because it would be nice to get invited to the party sometimes, but I've never been on any kind of Spotify editorial playlist. So it's all like either
the streams
on Spotify are either like algorithmic or they're other people's playlists. And so that, for whatever reason, that song does have an insane amount of streams. And it's organic, which is a good feeling. I don't know. I mean, I kind of know why, because it's short and catchy and it sounds like the Beatles. But also, yeah, I don't really know, you know, but it's cool. I mean, I'm like stoked that anybody would like something like, you know, that I do.
For sure. And to have that organically.
Yeah, it's like super cool to think about. Yeah.
Jeff, any final thoughts for Mo?
Well, I guess the final question is what comes next? Because the landscape of, at least of your album career and, you know, I Am the Cosmos as sort of a single that you put out, you know, apart from an album. But as far as the albums go, I feel like the landscape is dotted with a lot of diversity. And so it would be impossible to predict what you're going to do next. So I'm wondering if you've started thinking about that.
Yeah, I've actually started recording. I've been recording it since the beginning of the year, on and off. I'm using basically, I mean, you know, that the I Am the Cosmos single was like an experiment with how to use a 24 track. So I'm doing it on 24 track. And so it'll sort of be like, I mean, the idea is that it'll be kind of like tapey and sort of like utilize a lot of the things I learned working with an 8-track on the last record. So now I have 24 and it sounds better. I put out a single last month called For You to Sing, which is kind of like the first, it will be on the record. And that's like a sort of a general blueprint, I guess, or like, that's what the record will kind of sound like, I guess. Teaser.
Well, Mo, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
I'm glad we finally connected.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, what a great chat. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, awesome. Great to talk to you guys. Great to meet you.
You too.
You too.
See you guys. Have a good night.
Take care.
Thank you, Mo.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate you.
Many thanks to Mo for his time. You can stream all of Mo's work on Bandcamp and wherever you stream your favorite music. His article, Riding in Cars with Boys, The Eternal Heartache of Chris Bell's I Am the Cosmos, can be found in the inaugural issue of Remember the Lightning, a guitar pop journal, Volume 1, Spring-Summer, 2023. This literary homage to power pop also includes articles by James Goodson of the band Daisy and John M. Barak, Mike Randall of Baby Lemonade, Mary E. Donnelly, Rob Nesbitt of The Sweet 16, and S.W. Lorden, to whom we are deeply indebted for this episode.
Our theme song is Rocket Sled by Blip. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunderlove Studios.
Written and produced by Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley with the help of Mike Hunt. Edited by AJ Royce.
You heard the following songs during this podcast: Chris Bell's I Am the Cosmos and Big Star's Feel. You also heard Mo Troper's The Customer, Almost Full Control, The Only Living Goy in New York, and finally, I Fall Into Her Arms. Be sure to check out Mo Troper's Bandcamp site. You can stream Mo Troper, Chris Bell, and Big Star wherever you stream your favorite music.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
At Twitter, we are at Abandon Albums, and on Instagram, we are at Abandon_albums.
Grazie.
Bailey Leaf. Rob Janicki. Mike Pellegrino. Therina Bella. Ronnie Barnett. S.W. Loudon. Michael Janicki. Peyton Janicki. And our executive producer.
Rufus Thunderwolf.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.